It's really great to be back at Perimeter, and I'm very pleased to see the Institute is in the hands of such excellent young scientists as have organized this workshop. The young scientists should always be the drivers of the field, and it's great to see that happening here. I'm going to describe some work with Latham Boyle, who also is connected to Perimeter. And recently moved to Edinburgh, but he's also has a visiting position here. The motivation behind this work, let me say at the outset, this work is very preliminary, very tentative. Most of what we discuss is at the level of free quantum fields, but what we've discovered are some curious coincidences, which I think point us in very interesting directions. In a certain sense, what we're trying to do, maybe, if we're fortunate, is to build a four-dimensional version of string theory, which is unique in a similar sort of way. We're going to use concepts which are not dissimilar to string theory, but our hope is that this is far more economical and predictive. So the motivation for doing this is the observations, which have shown us that the universe is amazingly simple on large scales. Of course, there are tensions. People don't quite agree on the Hubble constant. There are various anomalies which occur from time to time. But so far, none of these are compelling. And so it's a distinct possibility that these five numbers suffice to describe everything about the large-scale universe. And so with that motivation, we're going to try to build a theory which is capable of explaining these five numbers, and I'm going to give you some first steps along the way. So what are the five numbers? The matter and energy content, the cosmological constant, if it is constant, appears to be, the dark matter density, or the ratio of dark matter to baryon density, the number of baryons per photons. Just three numbers describe the matter content of the universe, and two numbers describe the fluctuations. We parameterize these as a power spectrum of fluctuations in the large-scale Newtonian potential, for example. The power spectrum is very nearly perfectly scale invariant. I take that to be a very profound clue. The variance in real space receives equal contributions per log interval of k, almost. And then there's a slight tilt, which is usually parameterized by, in this way, k over k star ns minus 1, where ns is close to 1. So there are two numbers characterizing this, the amplitude of the power spectrum of fluctuations and this small tilt, which I'm going to interpret as a critical exponent. So I'm going to present a framework in which this ns minus 1 is really a calculable critical exponent, which holds, as I'll explain, over 30 orders of magnitude in length scale. So let me just emphasize, these are the only five numbers which are necessary to describe all of the phenomena we see in cosmology. And anybody who claims that they have a theory which explains more than just these five numbers is misleading you. This is all you need to fit all the current data. As we look out to the Big Bang, this is what we see. We see the CMB with its pattern of anisotropies. And correspondingly, we see beautiful power spectra in the CMB. These power spectra are direct consequences of the numbers I showed you. So the oscillations here do not indicate any fundamental theory. They're just a consequence of plasma physics, which is well understood. I was very fortunate to get into this business when the polarization hadn't yet been calculated for the CMB. An experimentalist told me this was too small to ever be measured, but fortunately we disregarded them, and now it's measured routinely. They are much better than they know, experimentalists. And this upper curve is actually predicted based on the parameters fit to the lower curve the upper curve is predicted with no free parameters. So that's quite remarkable. And to me, just shows us that physics is absolutely universal on the largest visible scales, the same physics we use on Earth. And it motivates me to strongly disbelieve notions of a multiverse or a universe which is chaotic on large scales. The universe is incredibly ordered, extremely simple, and the same physical laws appear to hold everywhere. In this talk, I'm going to present a unified framework. It's not unique, but it's an aspiration that we do need a framework which unifies particle physics with gravity and cosmology and makes genuine predictions. This framework is based on extrapolating the radiation epoch and the standard model all the way back to the initial singularity within a framework of a CPT symmetric ensemble. So I'm going to insist that the universe respects CPT symmetry. We've no reason to imagine that's violated, and it's certainly a possibility that the universe respects CPT. There will be no new particles except right-handed neutrinos, which are needed to explain neutrino oscillations anyway. I'll give a new explanation for why there are three generations of elementary particles. And with some minimal but important assumptions, I will show you how we quantitatively predict the two numbers describing the fluctuations. These two numbers are predicted in terms of standard model parameters, measured standard model parameters. And rather amazingly, they actually come out right. So, let me just emphasize this. Given how little is needed to describe the large-scale properties of the universe, any theory which is going to be convincing needs to be rather clear-cut and minimal. I simply don't believe that a complicated framework involving, for example, extra dimensions, compactifications, and so on and so forth is ever going to be compelling. We're trying to explain very little. The point is to understand which of these very few numbers is truly fundamental, interpret it correctly, and find the theoretical framework which explains it. That's the motivation. It may fail, of course, but that's what I want to try to do. So the basic hypothesis, the universe respects CPT symmetry. Why is this plausible? Well, our motivation for proposing this, it was extremely simple, which is that a radiation-dominated universe near the Big Bang singularity has a scale factor which goes linearly in conformal time. And if it's linear, it's analytic. So it's analytic at t equals zero. So you can consider the analytic extension of the space-time, which is unique. And one can analytically extend our observed universe to another side. This fact that the scale factor is linear in conformal time relies on the trace of the stress tensor going to zero at t equals zero. So there can be corrections, like mass terms and so on, but as long as they all become subdominant at the singularity, then this property will hold. So having noticed that the classical solutions respect CPT symmetry, it then becomes natural to say, well, let's just impose CPT symmetry on the path integral for gravity, and here I'm meaning the real-time Lorentzian path integral. Let's impose CPT symmetry so that if I just turn around the path integral, exchange the initial and the final states, it's invariant. And then what we're doing is imposing CPT symmetry by the method of images. And we should think about this pre-Bang universe as just an image, a mathematical image of the post-Bang universe, which is a useful construction so that we implement CPT symmetry around this singularity. Now, it's actually been known for a long time, but not interpreted this way, that for a perfect radiation fluid, if pressure is one-third the density, the stress tensor trace is zero, that means the fluid has local conformal symmetry, the fluid equations have local conformal symmetry. There are an infinity cubed of solutions to the Einstein fluid equations, which are analytic at t equals zero. So the scale factor goes like t. Now let's look in synchronous gauge and parameterize the three metric with a function of t and x. This entire conformal metric is regular. So the only singularity is the conformal factor going to zero. Everything else is regular. And then it turns out there are just the right number of solutions to the Einstein equations where hij of t and x is a regular three metric at t equals zero plus power series in even power series in t. So there are infinite number of such solutions. They're parameterized by a three metric. This is exactly the right number if you assume time reversal symmetry. So this is a complete set of saddles of the real time path integral for gravity with CPT symmetric boundary conditions. And every one of these solutions has a global isometry, t goes to minus t. The Big Bang singularity is conformal. You can calculate the Weyl tensor for this four metric. Of course, the t is irrelevant to the Weyl tensor. The scale factor is irrelevant. The Weyl tensor only depends on this, and you could just check that the Weyl tensor is zero at t equals zero for every one of these solutions. In fact, this is exactly Penrose's Weyl curvature hypothesis. And I see Roger quite regularly. I'm fortunate to see him quite regularly. And I'm trying to convince him that this hypothesis is actually better than his cyclic, conformal cyclic cosmology. He made it before the cyclic version, but I think it's a very profound idea. And the way we look at it is that this follows from CPT symmetry. Just impose CPT symmetry in the pre-bang, post-bang universe, the mirror image and ours, and Weyl curvature being zero at Big Bang follows. By the way, more complicated metrics are excluded because they're singular and not genuine saddles. So if you try to ask why didn't the universe start with Mixmaster or BKL, that's not a saddle of the path integral because it doesn't satisfy the Einstein equations, whereas these solutions all do. Now, the reason we got interested in this is that, is a surprising one, it gave the simplest yet explanation for the dark matter, as I'll explain. So I always thought before this that the dark matter was the one piece of solid evidence for physics beyond the Standard Model. But I'm going to show you that actually it isn't evidence for physics beyond the Standard Model. There is a natural candidate for the dark matter more or less within the Standard Model. And it's a right-handed neutrino. Right-handed neutrinos are automatically dark because they don't have any gauge charges. They do couple to gravity, so they're very natural candidates. Now, the reason right-handed neutrinos were introduced, hypothetically, was to explain light neutrino masses. If you have a left-handed neutrino, it's massless in the Standard Model, unless you include a right-handed version for it to oscillate into. So you have a left-handed neutrino couples to the Higgs vacuum expectation value, transmutes into a virtual right-handed neutrino, discovers it hasn't got enough energy because this guy is very heavy, and so it's only virtual, and quickly goes back to being left-handed. And so basically the mass it acquires through this mixing goes inversely with the mass of the right-handed neutrino. It's harder and harder to oscillate into, or at least you go into it for a shorter and shorter time, the heavier it is. So this mechanism, called the seesaw mechanism, was invoked to explain light neutrino masses a long time ago. So it turns out that if you take one of these right-handed neutrinos and you propagate it in this standard cosmological background, but now analytically extended through t equals zero, you can compute its abundance in the outgoing state, depending on what you assume for the quantum state of that right-handed neutrino. If you assume the CPT symmetric vacuum, which is a unique quantum state for the field, then the abundance of right-handed neutrinos in the late universe is completely predicted in terms of its mass. And then we just adjust the mass of the right-handed, basically it's created when its mass equals the Hubble constant. A given Fourier mode in the right-handed neutrino is created, a given momentum mode is created when the mass, I should just say, these neutrinos are basically created at a time when their mass equals the expansion rate or Hubble constant. And you match the observed dark matter density if one of them is stable and has this mass. So it's an extremely simple explanation. This was not proposed earlier, surprisingly, because these particles were never in thermal equilibrium. And nobody knew how to calculate their abundance, so they just assumed they were unstable, so the issue didn't arise. But if they are stable, then they are produced in this way. Now, how do we make them stable? A sort of fairly trivial way to do it is to impose a Z2 symmetry on one of the three right-handed neutrinos. Nu right goes to minus nu right. And this has the implication that the lightest neutrino is actually massless. So that's a prediction of this framework. If you impose this symmetry, you see, if you want it to be stable, you have to switch off this vertex. And if you switch off that vertex, you have to switch off this one, in which case the left-handed guy has nothing, doesn't oscillate into anything. So this is now being tested. In the next 3 to 5 years, we should know if the lightest neutrino is close to massless. The prediction here is that the sum of the three light neutrinos, some of their masses should be 60 millielectron volts, and the claim is that Euclid and LSST will measure that sum to an accuracy of about 12 millielectron volts. So it's rather amazing that the best way to measure neutrino masses is to use the clustering, of neutrinos under gravity in galaxy clusters. Now, all very well, but if we want to keep things simple, how do we explain the geometry of the universe? Why is the universe so simple on large scales? And of course, traditionally, one introduces inflation, and that requires extra fields and parameters and choices for initial conditions and so on. Can we do it without any of that? And the answer, I believe, is yes. So Penrose drew this wonderful picture of the creator creating a universe which is just ridiculously smooth, flat, isotropic, and that happens to be the one we live in. How do we get a measure on the set of universes? How do we decide what kind of universe is likely or unlikely? And what we're going to use is path integrals, and the path integral for gravity in particular, and the notion of gravitational entropy. So path integrals can be used for amplitudes, of course. That is the way we calculate amplitudes in the standard model. But they can also be used for calculating entropy. With periodic boundary conditions in imaginary time, the path integral, including gravity, gives you the partition function. And the partition function is just the exponential of the gravitational entropy. So the partition function is the exponential of minus the free energy over the temperature. But for a gravitational system, the energy is always zero. So the only contribution comes from the entropy. And so if you can calculate this partition function in imaginary time, it gives you the gravitational entropy. And that, of course, gives you a measure on possible universes. So this is a very well-established field now. Black holes, in the context of black holes have a Hawking temperature and a gravitational entropy. And the way in which it's calculated is exactly, well, one way is by going to imaginary time and computing the action of the path integral, finding the saddle point, and interpreting that as the entropy. So for De Sitter space, this was done a long time ago. Here's real De Sitter space. If you analytically continue the global time, it becomes a four-sphere, and then you just compute the exponent in the path integral and interpret this exponent as the gravitational entropy. And as is well known, this gives the result of about 10 to the 122 for the measured lambda. So this is a widely used method. Thank you. I better speed up a little bit. I want to say just some, I won't discuss any of the equations. We've done the same for cosmology. Realistic cosmology, here's the Friedmann equation with arbitrary radiation, matter, space curvature, and lambda. What people hadn't noticed is that the solution of this equation is periodic in imaginary time for any value of these parameters. Since it has a period that defines the Hawking temperature, you can, and since it's periodic, you can calculate the action over one period, and that gives you the gravitational entropy. So here is the function. It's a Jacobi elliptic function. It's periodic in the imaginary, in the complex T-plane. And here's a picture of the instanton for a generic universe. So we know this function now. It's uniquely fixed by Einstein's action. We've calculated it. We treat inhomogeneities in cosmological perturbation theory. And what we find is that it's greatest for a flat homogeneous isotropic universe. So, which is essentially what we see. It's also greatest if the cosmological constant is small and positive. That was observed a long time ago, and it holds in these general cosmologies as well. Notice that this SG is the global entropy for the entire space-time. It's independent of real-time via Cauchy's theorem. When you calculate it, you have to do it around a cycle, around the torus, and if you move that cycle around, the answer doesn't change. So it's a global number associated with the four geometry. This is a thermodynamic explanation. No additional smoothing or flattening mechanism is required. I just want to briefly mention there are connections with recent advances in non-equilibrium stat mech. There is an entropy of a trajectory of a particle in a hot medium, and it also employs this time-reversed trajectory, the mirror image universe, which I mentioned. So there is a way of approaching something like the second law of cosmological dynamics, which I hope will generalize the second law of black hole thermodynamics. So quickly now, I'm going to tell you about the fluctuations. How do we get the fluctuations in such a universe without inflation? The answer is to go back and think carefully about how quantum fields couple to gravity and the various problems. The worst problem, well, the most immediate problem is that the vacuum stress energy is divergent in the standard model. And it doesn't really make sense to couple that to gravity. One can renormalize it away, but it leaves us with rather little physical understanding. Similarly, these quantum divergers spoil the conformal invariance of Maxwell and Dirac fields through trace anomalies, which cannot be renormalized away. So what do we do about these? We found a way to cancel all three without supersymmetry. It's a novel mechanism which doesn't require any new particles. All it does is distorts the vacuum of the standard model. And this method was lying around in the literature. It employs four derivative fields with a simple quadratic action. Lots of people investigated this. Bob Holden gave a talk about an interacting version of this theory. And you may remember he had a special curve in his plot of couplings. We're studying that theory, the interacting theory, on that special curve, where, if you noticed, all his cross-sections are zero. The reason they're zero is there's only one physical state in that theory, and that's the vacuum. Okay, so it's an interesting theory. Bogoliubov et al. Realized or interpreted this theory as the simplest gauge theory. It's a simple gauge theory because it has an infinite dimensional symmetry, phi goes to phi plus alpha, where box alpha is zero, so it's harmonic, and this allows you to remove all the negative norm states, as in a gauge theory. The unique physical state is the vacuum, and that's why I was interested in it. Now, let's play a numbers game. Here's the vacuum energy in the standard model for every Fourier mode of a field, you get h bar omega times various numbers. Dimension one scalars, fermions have a negative vacuum energy, and so on. So these dimension zero scalars have turned out to have a two there. Then you can calculate the conformal anomalies, the Euler term, and the Weyl squared terms. They're all sums of integers. So let's just play a little numbers game. Is it possible to cancel all three? So it turns out that the coefficients of the last three numbers are there's a linear dependence. So if I ignore this, these three equations are linearly dependent. So all three vanish only if the number of dimension one scalars is zero. That's kind of sad that I hold the Higgs chair at Edinburgh, but I'm saying that the Higgs is not fundamental. According to this theory, it's not allowed, nor is an inflaton. It's just not allowed. Okay, not allowed to introduce dimension one scalars if you believe this argument. So you cancel the first term. Any two of the remaining equations then give the same prediction that the number of fermions is four times the number of gauge bosons, and furthermore that the dimension zero fields are three times the number of gauge bosons. For the Standard Model gauge group, you predict 48 fermions. That's exactly three generations, where each generation has a right-handed neutrino. So this is admittedly a very simplistic prediction of three families, relies only on free field theory. I think Bob Holden's calculations lend some credence to this, because he showed that this quartic theory was asymptotically free, and this cancellation is necessary if we're going to have a traceless stress tensor at the Big Bang. I don't have time to discuss this. What I just briefly mention, that with this cancellation, you dramatically improve the property of the graviton propagator coupled to the Standard Model. You cancel various terms which lead to complex poles and violate the Kalman-Lehmann representation. So this cancellation does very good things for quantum gravitons. I want to end just by telling you about our most recent paper where we explain the perturbations. This is actually why we got interested in these fields in the first place. If you look at the Standard Model couplings around the Planck energy, the strong coupling, which turns out to dominate, is asymptotically free, meaning that its strength decreases as you go to short scales. That's exactly what we see in the sky. It's a similar red tilted spectrum. So it turns out that the spectral tilt induced in the perturbations which are generated by these dimensionless fields is dominated by QCD, and asymptotic freedom gives the red tilt. We have to go through an argument, which I can't explain here, but happy to talk about, that the power spectrum of perturbations scales as alpha squared. Alpha is the strong coupling constant, leads to a prediction that NS minus 1 is minus 7 over pi alpha QCD at the Planck scale. Amazingly, that's spot on the Planck result. Since it's a critical exponent, i.e. the result of dimensions, an anomalous dimension, you can extrapolate it to any scale, and we have to extrapolate it over 30 orders of magnitude from the Planck length at the Planck time to today's co-moving Hubble radius at the Planck time, which is about 10 microns, but it's 30 orders of magnitude. That's what we do. Amazingly, extrapolating this to the observed scale, the amplitude agrees to within a factor of 2, and this scaling exponent is very close too. Here's the formula for the final power spectrum of curvature perturbations. It involves the three gauge coupling constants, number of degrees of freedom in the Standard Model. But really, this was a huge surprise. We didn't expect things to work this simply. It's only leading order. We've ignored the Higgs because, as I said, we're not allowed to have a Higgs and be consistent with conformal symmetry. So there are all kinds of corrections that could come into this. So thank you very much for listening.